Lecture 9, The Great Game of Empires.
Let's begin with a scene from the great game of imperialist competition in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. Usually, Japanese military attachés were known for their efficiency and seriousness. Why, then, did it take Major Tanaka Geichi 2 whole months in 1902 to get from his earlier post at the Japanese embassy in St. Petersburg, Russia, to Tokyo? 2 whole months was an almost medieval rate of travel. Major Tanaka was not dawdling or idling about. Rather, he was purposefully lingering in his travels along the strategically vital Trans-Siberian Railroad, which was almost completed. The fact of the Trans-Siberian Railroad, which ran all the way from St. Petersburg and Moscow in the west to the Pacific in the east, worried the Japanese because it meant that Russia would be able to move troops more quickly across its vast expanse, thus increasing its military power. Tanaka also sailed the Sungari and Amur rivers, visited Vladivostok and Port Arthur on the Pacific, and only then headed across the sea for Japan. Clearly, this was not a route that MapQuest would have recommended. But his superiors were very pleased with the report that he submitted and promoted him to the general staff, and eventually he went on to a political career. Along the way in his meandering travels, Tanaka all the time had been observing, asking questions in Russian, which he'd learned well by this time, and committing strategic and military details to memory for the day when the Russian and Japanese empires would collide. In terms of tradecraft, there was a serious lesson here too. Sometimes the most effective intelligence gathering, the most valuable intelligence gathering, only involves seeing what is there before you, obvious and out in the open, if you only know what to look for. This can potentially be far more effective than secret intrigue and searching for confidential documents. And this was Tanaka's approach, and it served him well, as we'll see later in this lecture. The later 19th century saw an increased scramble for empire as European powers, especially Great Britain, France, Russia, and Germany, sought to carve out for themselves overseas realms in Asia, Africa, and the Pacific. By 1914, the world had largely been divided. 3/4 of the globe had been occupied by the European empires. This was a brutal contest, and this imperialism exacted a huge cost in suffering from colonized peoples. And then, in a sense, the enterprise ended up boomeranging back on Europe. As the globe was divided up, competition between the European empires grew, and wars flared up between them. In this intensely competitive and tense environment, spying was both institutionalized and increasingly celebrated in fiction as a great game. In the imperialism of the 19th century, there was one particular empire that was head and shoulders above the rest, one empire on which the sun never set, as the expression went. This was Great Britain's empire. After losing the American colonies, Britain had constructed another empire for itself, global in reach, and then, as the 19th century proceeded, fueled by the Industrial Revolution, in which Britain also took the lead, Britain came to be called the workshop of the world. By 1870, Britain is said to have accounted for nearly a third of all global industrial production. The British Empire was the largest that the world had ever witnessed. By 1913, its dimensions were astonishing. It encompassed 458 million subjects, 1/4 of the world's population and habitable land. The jewel in the crown of this structure was the British possession of India. British India encompassed then what is today India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Myanmar. From 1757, when the British won a preeminent position on the subcontinent, all the way until 1947, when the British withdrew, India was a linchpin of British imperialism. Commensurately, British fears of losing India were intense. It was commonly said that if India were to be lost, Britain would sink to the status of a second-rate power. The very fact that Britain was the leader of worldwide imperialism made it fearful of its leading status and produced a feeling of being threatened by rivals on all sides. British policymakers worried about France, about Russia, and then about the new German Empire that had been born in 1871. After a century of general peace throughout the 19th century, without a huge war as had been seen in the days of Napoleon, there was now a growing sense in Europe that there would sooner or later be a great war again. The British were very concerned about Russian expansion in Central Asia, as they feared that Russian influence was encroaching upon India. In 1898, to add further worries, France and Britain almost came to blows over their rival African claims. Around 1900, Germany, which had its tremendously formidable and victorious land army that had defeated in quick succession Denmark, Austria, and then France, now was also building up a navy. Further alarming news came about the building of the Kiel Canal in Germany across the base of the Danish peninsula, which would connect the Baltic and the North Seas and would allow the new and growing German fleet to speedily pass back and forth from one area to the other, further expanding its military potential. All of this seemed a threat to Britain's naval power that ruled the waves. The result was arms races and growing tension. And this, in turn, encouraged increasingly institutionalized and professionalized espionage. In this context, new intelligence gathering tasks were given to people in particular positions, military attachés. What is a military attaché? A military attaché is an official who is assigned to an embassy in a foreign country as part of the diplomatic staff. So military attachés enjoy diplomatic immunity, but they're able to use this role to get familiar with the country in which their embassy is located, to learn about its military, in general, to observe. From 1850, attachés became increasingly commonly included in embassies, in part as a way of great powers observing each other, perhaps cooperating, generally keeping tabs on the military establishment of friends as well as rivals. On the British side, this role attracted gentlemen with a love of adventure, perhaps following in the fictional footsteps of the Scarlet Pimpernel. Such agents who played the role of military attachés included Robert Baden-Powell, who later founded the Boy Scout movement. On trips through the Balkans, Baden-Powell posed as a butterfly hobbyist. What could be more harmless? A man searching after rare species of butterflies. He, in fact, was using this as a cover or pretext to observe and closely note the details of military fortifications. And if you had looked over Baden-Powell's shoulder and had looked at the sketches of butterfly wings that he was making, you would see a remarkable coincidence. The markings on those butterfly wings corresponded exactly to the outlines of the fortifications that he was observing. Another military attaché was Captain Reginald Blinker Hall, who would later lead the British code-breaking effort in World War I, as we'll discuss in an upcoming lecture. Hall, in 1908, had effectively spied on the German naval base of Kiel in the Baltic Sea by borrowing the motorboat of a British duke and conveniently having it break down, he was in fact pretending, having it break down opposite new naval construction. Hidden inside the interior of their motorboat were two of his officers who were taking pictures from this hidden position. The need for good intelligence to face new menaces was especially clearly borne in on the British because of a recent cautionary tale about what would happen if one did not have adequate intelligence. The story was this. Seized by worry about a Russian threat to India, in 1839 to 1842, a British army invaded Afghanistan to prevent the Russians from intervening in Afghanistan first. This campaign was a disaster. Finally, only one British survivor returned from the terrible retreat from Kabul in the year 1842. Bad intelligence had caused this disaster. This scene, moreover, took place in locations where American troops are stationed today. The deadly rivalry between Great Britain and Russia fought out along buffer zones, fought out by proxy in the valleys and gulches of Central Asia, was given a ironically cheerful name with some irony, The Great Game. And it would be a name that would be popularized in the writings of the British writer Rudyard Kipling. Rudyard Kipling published a key novel that celebrated the Great Game in 1901. It was entitled Kim. Kipling had been born in 1865 in India. He had gone on to be schooled in Britain and then became a journalist and writer who celebrated empire and imperialism. Kipling himself has been both celebrated and has been controversial in the days of his lifetime as well as in our own present day. In his own day, he was one of the most popular writers of the era. He was, in fact, awarded the 1907 Nobel Prize for Literature as the first English writer to be so honored, and is still to date its youngest recipient. That subtle writer, Henry James, praised Kipling as a true genius. But today, Kipling is controversial because he was clearly an enthusiast for empire and also gave expression to racist ideas, most notably in the infamous poem White Man's Burden of 1899, which spoke of an imperial civilizing mission in non-European parts of the world and spoke of non-European peoples as being, quote, half devil and half child, end quote. What complicates any easy and total condemnation of Kipling is that he was capable of unusual sympathy, unusual for his day certainly, for the subjects of imperialism, aware of the abuses of imperialism, and he was at the same time a writer of great talents. Kipling's novel Kim is set in India, probably in the 1890s. The main character is a boy, an orphan of an Irish soldier. The boy's name is Kimball O'Hara. But we meet him first, not as an obviously Irish child, but rather someone who appears to be an Indian boy, playing with other Indian boys, speaking local languages, and passing easily as a local. Once Kim is identified as in fact being a European, the British authorities try to take him in hand. But Kim rebels against being sent to St. Xavier's School, subject to its intense discipline as a military academy. He's always told, Kimball, we don't act like that here at St. Xavier's School. Instead, Kim increasingly delights at being taken into the activities of Colonel Creighton, a British intelligence officer, and he enjoys the difficult training of being a spy. Kim befriends a Tibetan priest, a lama, whom he encounters as the lama goes about on his mystic quest through India. And together, Kim and the Tibetan priest journey through India, experiencing its diversity, reveling in its variety. And Kim helps in the process to foil Russian agents who are planning the subversion of British control of India, an invasion from Afghanistan, and ultimately Russian control of the jewel in the crown. As the novel closes, there's every promise that as Kim grows older and grows up into an adult, he'll continue in his intelligence activities as a future master player of the great game. The novel describes the great game as one that the agent must play alone, utterly alone, and for ultimate stakes, perhaps even his life. Only a very select few have been born, the novel argues, who are up to playing this game. They are those who are driven by a lust for travel, risk, and discovery, whether of far-off things or of nearby evil and plots that are being planned by foolish men. And so these destined few play a game, the game which goes on. And Kim is instructed, when everyone is dead, the great game is finished, but not before. The great game is a dangerous game played for its own sake. This novel resonates as a classic of spy fiction, and it also had later influential historical echoes as well. Kim Philby, the double agent who pretended to be a British intelligence officer but was in fact spying for the Soviets and who was one of the most effective spies of the entire Cold War, is said to have taken his nickname from the novel. His first name actually had been Harold, but he chose the name Kim for its associations. Meanwhile, on the Russian side, The Russian secret services at this time were playing a different dangerous game, one that would eventually explode in the face of the very Tsarist regime that these efforts were intended to protect. You'll recall from a recent previous lecture that after the assassination of Tsar Alexander II by terrorists in 1881, the recently organized Okhrana had gone into action. Okhrana means, can be translated as the protective service. It went into action on an international scale. The Okhrana had a staff of 20,000 and a huge budget commensurate with its importance to the Tsarist regime. The Okhrana acted in many ways outside of the supervision of regular laws, and this made it unique among contemporary major agencies. It was a law unto itself. And yet, the activities of the Okhrana, as feared as it was at the time, seem mild by the standards of the record of later secret police repression. Even in the 1880s, only 17 people were executed in Russia for political crimes, mostly for being party to assassination plots. Internally, the Okhrana had to deal with a spate of political murders in Russia, and there were many prominent victims among those who were targeted. They included an assassinated education minister, a prime minister, and two ministers of the interior. And this last one hurt especially because these were the men who were in charge of the Okhrana itself. The murder of the second minister of the interior was an especially dubious tale. His murder had been organized by Yevno Azef, a social revolutionary radical, who it turned out was also at the same time an agent of the Okhrana. The man who shot the prime minister at the opera was also a revolutionary. Clearly, the strategy of trying to infiltrate revolutionary societies was having very ambivalent results. This fact showed that the Okhrana had succeeded in infiltrating revolutionary secret societies, but at the cost of often fatal confusion as to who was really working for whom. It's been said about Azef that he was in the end confused as to whether he was actually a revolutionary spying on the police or a policeman spying on the revolutionaries. As a further example of the successful infiltration by the Okhrana of revolutionary societies, one should mention the Bolshevik Party. This was the smaller and more radical socialist faction of the Social Democratic Party. The Bolsheviks were led by Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. The leader of the party in the parliament, and thus a close comrade of Lenin's, was Roman Malinovsky. He was admired by Lenin as a friend and also admired for being one of the few Bolshevik leaders who actually had a genuine working class background. He was not a middle class intellectual who championed the working class. He actually was from the working class. Another and dubious example of a similar lineage was Stalin, whom we'll talk more about later. Malinovsky, as it turns out, also was a spy for the Okhrana. Lenin, when he heard the news, at first refused to believe it, but on finally being convinced, he had Malinovsky shot. At one point, the Bolshevik leadership in the city of St. Petersburg numbered 5, and 4 of those were Okhrana agents. At a certain point, it might have been more convenient just to hold Bolshevik meetings at the Okhrana headquarters. Another disastrous example of attempts to infiltrate and manipulate, which ended up backfiring, was a phenomenon in Russia called police socialism. Police socialism was the attempt to organize trade unions for Russian workers that would actually secretly be steered and managed by police authorities. This was thought to be a splendid way of managing radicalism, diffusing it, and channeling demands for change in a loyal direction, not undermining the Tsarist regime, but in a sense reinforcing it. The idea probably sounded good in theory, but its practice left much to be desired. The leader of one of these unions was a Russian Orthodox priest, Father Georgi Gapon. In January 1905, Father Gapon led crowds of loyal workers carrying icons and pictures of the Tsar in a demonstration, not a demonstration of protest, but a demonstration of devotion to the Tsar. This crowd approached the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg. The guards at the palace had not been informed of this upcoming demonstration, And so they gunned down the protesters, fearing that this was a riot in the offing rather than a patriotic demonstration. This event was catalytic in changing public opinion in Russia. It came to be called Bloody Sunday. It turned many Russians against the institution of Tsardom as such, if it were capable of shooting down its own loyal people. Gapon was later killed by revolutionaries who despised him because of his double agent role. Many Russian radicals, including Vladimir Lenin, the leader of the Bolsheviks, had to live and agitate in exile, and the Okhrana pursued them there as well. So it had an international presence in addition. It was estimated that some 5,000 revolutionaries abroad were devoting themselves to overthrowing Tsarism as the new century began. The Okhrana set up a branch office to keep track of such revolutionaries. The branch office was set up in Paris around 1882, and there it cooperated with the French intelligence services, the Sûreté. This is a further example of a theme we've already mentioned before, of the sometimes remarkable international cooperation of intelligence services. The manager of the Okhrana's Paris branch was Pyotr Rachkovsky, a fat, jolly, and amorous bureaucrat. While it seemed that he spent most of his time chasing after the beauties of Paris, in fact, he was engaged in conspiratorial work undercover. Spies in Britain, Switzerland, Italy, and Germany were run out of this Paris office. In 1890, Rachkovsky revealed a sensation. He uncovered a bomb plot among Russian exiles in Paris. These revolutionaries had planned a terrorist outrage, Rachkovsky announced. Rachkovsky was in a great position to have lots of information on this plot, as he had actually been the one who had organized it. This is a classic example of the phenomenon of provocation, an act that was intended to discredit those who were its alleged authors. And indeed, there was a lot of anxiety at the time precisely about radical revolutionaries and what they might get up to in Paris as well as elsewhere around the world. Around this time, around 1903, there also appeared in Russia a notorious forgery, which was to have repercussions decades afterwards. This notorious forgery was the so-called Protocols of the Elders of Zion. This dubious document claimed to be the exposition of a global conspiracy of Jews to take over the world. It has long been suspected that Okhrana agents, perhaps Rachkovsky himself, some have suggested, were the authors of this document or had some hand in its production. Precisely what the circumstances are of who wrote it and under what in what context is not remains still unclear. The Tsarist government was eager for its part to divert attention from the often poor conditions in Russia by scapegoating a vulnerable minority, the Jews. They were a persecuted group, subject to periodic pogroms, riots against their community, and violence which the government did not prevent and even tacitly encouraged. After World War I, this paranoid text, The Protocols, circulated worldwide in translation. It was reprinted by Henry Ford, was admired by the Nazis, cited by Hitler in Mein Kampf. Even today, it circulates in Arab countries in the Middle East, and a few years ago in Egypt was produced as a mini-series for TV. It's a classic and notorious example of conspiracy thinking. Even as the competition of empires was playing out, there were three wars in quick succession which made clear that the world was changing at an unprecedented pace, that the balance of power was starting to shift in unpredictable and worrying ways. The first example. In 1898, the United States decisively defeated a once great imperial power, Spain, in the Spanish-American War, announcing America's emergence into world politics. This war was actually sparked by a suspected covert operation. On the night of February 15, 1898, the USS Maine in harbor in Havana blew up, killing 260 American Navy men. The suspicion was that it had been blown up by a bomb or torpedo. In fact, we know now that it's likelier that this was a mechanical boiler malfunction. Despite there never having been proof that this was caused by the Spanish, most Americans believed it was a Spanish act. And "Remember the Maine" became a rallying cry for this war, which left the U.S. in possession of overseas territory. A year later, the Boer War broke out as the British sought to subdue Dutch settlers in South Africa. This war went very badly for the British, who lacked the necessary military intelligence to prevail. Even more, the British were dismayed as world criticism turned against Britain for the way in which it was conducting this war against guerrillas, the way the British had created so-called concentration camps to confine the Boer civilian population to stop them from aiding the guerrilla fighters in the field. This, along with German expressions of sympathy for the Boers, made Britain's isolation clear. Earlier, Britain had enjoyed a sense of being standing alone and of enjoying splendid isolation. Now it became a cause for worry. So Britain did something unprecedented in the modern period. It sought out allies in peacetime and found them, first of all, in Japan in 1902, and then came to friendly agreements with France in 1904 and with Russia in 1907. Of these wars, the third one is probably the most important. The third war was the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 to 1905, which announced as clearly as anyone could wish a new fact, the rise of Japan as a non-Western imperialist power. Oddly enough, the more time elapses from the Russo-Japanese War, the more important it looks to historians. Why so? Japan's deliberate planned modernization of the previous decades had produced a non-European great power that sought by sheer will and determination in what was a breathtaking inspiration to submerged peoples around the world, those who were in the grip of other colonial empires. In a sense, the whole process of decolonization began here, not just after World War II. Japan had pursued, as I've mentioned, a deliberate program of learning from and adapting from European sources. And a key way of doing this was by sending Japanese officers and military attachés, like Tanaka, on study trips abroad. These were called rugaku. The study trips would allow them to learn all they could and bring the knowledge back. Japanese naval officers were sent to Britain because of Britain's naval preeminence. Army officers were sent to Germany because of its superior army. Sensing that Russia would be a rival in East Asia, Japanese officers were sent there as well. Just like Tanaka, they observed the Trans-Siberian Railroad, observed Russian military practice, and then returned to write up reports on what they had learned with beautifully poetic names. Two examples. One of the reports was entitled, "The Flowers Are Fallen, The Water Flows On." Another report was called, "Flowers of the Open Country." I think that bureaucracies today should take up this example and remove their bureaucratic lingo and replace it with such poetic and far more interesting rhetoric. Secret agents were also sent by the Japanese into Manchuria and China to observe the Russians. And they were helped in this task by Russia's underestimation of the Japanese and, in a sense, by their ethnic condescension. To the Russians, Japanese agents, in their appearance, were hard to distinguish from Chinese or Mongolians. In ethnic condescension, these peoples all seemed somehow monolithically Asian. As in the case of African Americans in the Civil War, racial attitudes and ethnic condescension could work to the advantage of a Japanese agent. When war did break out between Japan and Russia, Russia collapsed into revolution. This was a deeply shocking defeat, as the Japanese had sunk two Russian fleets. In perhaps the long-term consequence that was of most important, this was a sign that non-Westerners could defeat Europeans. And Japanese spying had helped to achieve maximum surprise and maximum damage. All of this announced that the world was changing fast and that this was a time of shifting balances of power. This sense of how quickly the world could change unexpectedly encouraged mass panics about spying. And we'll be turning to precisely these mass panics in our next lecture. So get ready to seriously panic.